Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope that you had a great weekend here in North Dakota. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's Earth Day, or should I say Earth Week events that are being celebrated April 22nd and April 24th in Valley City. Events include a showing of The Jungle, an update on the Upton Sinclair 1906 novel on the meatpacking industry, also a discussion about the movie Northern Nights, Starry Skies, and more. And we begin Main Street on this Monday with the news that Pope Francis has died today, and it's just one day after appearing publicly to bless crowds for Easter, ending a historic and transformative pontificate. Known for his humility and advocacy for the poor, migrants, and the marginalized, Pope Francis sought to make the Catholic Church more inclusive and outward-looking. His death followed recent health struggles, including a severe case of pneumonia, yet he continued to make surprise appearances in his final days. Tributes poured in from around the world, honoring him as a global moral voice and a pope for everyone. His passing now begins the traditional process of selecting his successor, with questions about whether the church will continue on the path he's forged or shift direction. Joining me to discuss is Monsignor James Patrick Shea, who has served as the sixth president of the University of Mary since 2009. He is a Catholic priest of the Diocese of Bismarck here in North Dakota. Monsignor Shea, welcome to Main Street.
I'm happy to be here with you, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, we all saw Pope Francis give Easter blessings from the Vatican, and this morning, now we've heard the news that he has died. When you learned of the Pope's passing, Monsignor, what went through your mind?
I heard about it very early this morning because I was actually on my way to an event in Washington, D.C., which subsequently was canceled because of the Holy Father's passing. And so as a result, I didn't get on the plane this morning to leave Bismarck. But I heard about it very early this morning, and I have to say that I was surprised by it. You know, he was hospitalized. He was rushed to Gemelli Hospital in Rome back in February, and I think that there were some people, because of his condition, who didn't think that he would ever leave the hospital. And yet he did. He came back to the Casa Santa Marta, the place where he lives in the Vatican, and he was able to meet with various people. He met with the Vice President of the United States yesterday morning, and then he appeared on the loggia, the balcony or the platform on the facade of St. Peter's Basilica yesterday morning, Easter Sunday, as the popes always do for an annual Urbi et Orbi blessing. That's a special blessing which is given to the city of Rome and to the world, and usually what goes with that is an annual message about the importance of the new life that comes with Easter and of world peace. And so he delivered that message yesterday. Our students, you know, the University of Mary has a campus in Rome. So we have 35 students who have been over there since January, and they did miss their chance to see him in February. They were scheduled for a papal audience in February, the day after he was hospitalized. And so they missed their chance to see him then. They were with him yesterday morning. And so students from North Dakota, from the University of Mary, were in the front row when Pope Francis made his last public appearance yesterday in St. Peter's Square for the Urbi et Orbi blessing. I don't think any of us thought at that time that we would wake up the next day to hear that he had died. But of course, we had been keeping vigil for him ever since his hospitalization.
In what ways, Monsignor, do you believe Pope Francis has reshaped the Catholic Church's image and maybe mission moving forward now in our modern world?
Well, the last 12 years have been a tumultuous time in our world. In the United States, we've had a lot of political turmoil. Globally, it's been an uncertain time. Lots of striking issues have been present for us to wrangle through. And in the midst of that, Pope Francis has brought his own perspective to these conversations. You know, he's the first pope from the Southern Hemisphere, the first pope from the Americas. He's the first pope who's a member of the Society of Jesus, which was, that's the Jesuits. It's a religious order. They were the founders of some of the great Catholic universities in our country and around the world, and yet they've never had one of their company become the pope before. And so Pope Francis was a pope of firsts in many ways. He has said many things which have been picked up, especially by the Western media, as signs that he wants to change church teaching. The experience for those of us who, of course, are Catholics, or for those of us who, as I am, are leading Catholic institutions, hasn't been so much of a question about the change of teaching, but about a change of culture. And he signaled that from the very beginning, didn't he, when he said that he wouldn't be living in the apartments of the Apostolic Palace, right, but rather he'd be living in a humble guest house. The ways in which, from the very beginning, he's reached out to the poor and the marginalized, the way that he's prioritized issues like immigration and climate change. Pope Francis has indicated an emphasis, but more than anything, through the course of the last 12 years, he has led a shift in culture in the Catholic Church. That's what he wanted to be his legacy from the beginning. That's why he took the name Francis after Francis of Assisi, who very famously was close to the poor.
He's often been described as the people's pope, and you've kind of reflected on that momentarily. What do you think made him so personally accessible and beloved, even beyond really the Catholic faithful?
Yeah, Francis had a way about him. You know, I've seen him in person several times, and his personal warmth, his appreciation for people, his spontaneity, his unwillingness really to stick to a script was sometimes disconcerting for those of us who have to day by day discharge the mission of the church and lead institutions that are part of the Catholic Church's mission. But at the same time, for the people, that was just very endearing to have a pope who would sometimes say unexpected things, unconventional things, who would go off script, not infrequently. You know, he would have a prepared speech that he'd be giving for a gathering, and then the pope would veer off in one direction or another. And I think that people really found that very human. And so he did a lot to humanize the papacy, Pope Francis did. And so I think that's why there was such a sense of closeness. But there's no doubt about it that the Catholic world and the world itself felt deeply his call to be more attentive to the needs of the poor and the marginalized, those who may have been left out. And that's very important in a time of unprecedented affluence, which is the time in which we live.
For students around the world, and not only for the students in Rome from the University of Mary, but the students who are in Bismarck, how are they reflecting today on the Pope's legacy?
Well, we'll have a couple of memorial masses on our campus today, and those will be packed because our students feel very deeply connected to the Universal Church. That's on purpose. You know, not every student at the University of Mary is a Catholic. Not every student at the University of Mary obviously studies at our campus in Rome. And yet we try and do our best to make sure that our students have a true global perspective and that they're plugged into the things that are happening around the world. The passing of a pope who in the Catholic Church is the Bishop of Rome and the Universal Shepherd of the Church, but also who's a significant world leader, that's something which our students will mark very much. And so I think they've reflected all throughout the time in which he served as Pope upon his legacy, upon his teaching. And in a particular way, they'll be thinking about that today. In particular, of course, the students at our Rome campus are there at a time of great historical importance. In other words, imagine being 21 years old, living abroad in Rome. Maybe you've never been on an airplane before. We have students who go over to our Rome campus who have never been on an airplane. And so maybe you're in that situation. And finally, you find yourself in the middle of an epic drama. All eyes for the next 4 weeks or so, all eyes will be on Rome because we'll have the papal funeral. And then after that, there's a period of deliberation. All of the cardinals of voting age from all over the world will arrive in Rome for the Pope's funeral and then for the papal conclave. And then there will be the election of a new Pope. And so this is a really amazing time to be alive, to witness these events, as all of us will, at a distance, and to be a student living and studying in Rome at this time is a very, very special thing.
We're enjoying our conversation with Monsignor James Patrick Shea from the University of Mary. He's the school's sixth president, and he has served since 2009. He's a Catholic priest of the Diocese of Bismarck here in North Dakota, and we are reflecting on the passing of Pope Francis. What impact, Monsignor, do you believe that Pope Francis has had here in the Catholic Church in North Dakota? And can you speak to any specific changes or inspiration that have been drawn from his teachings?
Well, so both the Diocese of Bismarck and the Diocese of Fargo have students or young priests who study abroad in Rome. And so I think, you know, I used to be a high school teacher before I came to the University of Mary, and many of my students, my former students from when I taught high school, and then some students from the University of Mary as well, have gone over to study at the North American College, which is the American seminary in Rome. Those students are in very close contact with the Pope, and they're at papal events. Many times they'll serve for him in various large public ceremonies, and they'll come back deeply formed and shaped by his teaching. And so I think many of the young priests in our dioceses, in Western and in Eastern North Dakota, would have, for instance, I'll use one example, the apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the gospel. This was released very early on in Pope Francis's pontificate. And this was an exhortation that the way that the gospel, the teaching of the church and the teaching of Jesus in the gospels is meant to be spread, Pope Francis said, was by means of contagious joy, that he didn't want a church which was overly solemn or somber. And I think that when I look out, when I gaze at the landscape of the Catholic Church in our state here in North Dakota, I see the gospel being preached very joyfully. I see our young priests, particularly in their work with young people at our Catholic high schools or in their parishes, and oftentimes they've taken up the challenge of Pope Francis, both to be close to the people, not to speak in a distant or authoritarian way, but in a way which accompanies people. I see that happening, and then I see it being done with this disposition of joy, which Pope Francis had called to. And so I think, once again, in the same way that I don't think his legacy has to do as much with the changing of teaching as much as the changing of culture. In the same way, I think that that what it signaled here in North Dakota, close to the people in our parishes, is a change in tone. In other words, he's exhorted us to be joyful and close to the people.
I'm not a Catholic, Monsignor, but I've certainly noticed his advocacy for the poor, for migrants, his willing to discuss climate issues. Has that had an influence on local parish life here in our state?
Well, so Bishop Fulda in Fargo and Bishop Kagan here in Bismarck, I think, are very faithful in the way that they're attentive to any of the decrees or the teachings which have come from the Vatican over the course of the last 12 years. And so I think certainly the teachings of Pope Francis are taken into account, for instance, when the Catholic Conference, which is the church's lobbying agency for the meeting of the state legislature, which is happening right now and which happens every other year, those priorities are taken by Christopher Dodson and now by Dr. David Tamasia, who work closely with the bishops when they're talking about the formation of state policy, legislative priorities, those kinds of things. Of course, the Pope is always issuing things that Catholics should be praying about or concerned with. And we have heard very much about these questions, about the poor, about immigration, about climate change, those kinds of things. And so I think that teaching in that respect and action in that respect has been much more in the air as a result of the priorities of Pope Francis.
One of the most difficult parts of my conversation with you comes now, Monsignor. How, in your eyes, did Pope Francis's approach to sexual abuse reform and financial transparency too in the church impact the church's reputation and accountability even here in the state?
Well, so I think that it's no secret to anybody, Craig, that the church has lived through a kind of nightmarish time in regard to some of these issues. And it's not it's not so much that the church is suffering, but we think of the suffering of victims of sexual abuse, for instance, and the way that the church sometimes has neglected them, or, and the more recent aspect of that whole scandal had to do with the case of Theodore McCarrick, who also just passed away here recently, who was a high-ranking cardinal. He was removed not just from his work as a cardinal, from his position as a cardinal, but he was removed from the priesthood itself during the papacy of Pope Francis. And so I think we've seen a sexual abuse scandal both in this country and in other places in the world, I think particularly of places like Chile in South America. And Pope Francis has needed to grapple with that along the way. By his own admission, there are certain things which he did really well in terms of reform. I think of the establishment of a particular task force, which was led by Cardinal Sean O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, which was meant particularly to address these questions. But I think there were some mistakes made as well along the way, and the Pope himself admitted that. And so I think that the Pope's legacy on questions of sexual abuse in the church is mixed, and that has had an effect, there's no doubt about it, on the church's capacity effectively to preach the gospel. We've had our own struggles here in North Dakota. I think Bishop Kagan and Bishop Fulda have done a really good job in terms of transparency around these kinds of questions. But Pope Francis really led the way for us in wanting the church to be penitent around these questions and to attend to the needs of the survivors of sexual abuse. In terms of questions of financial transparency, I think that's one of the reasons, quite frankly, that he was elected in 2013. There was a sense among the cardinals that that there was a need for reform in terms of the finances of the Vatican. And Cardinal George Pell from Australia was appointed to lead that effort. And so I think that they've come a long way in respect to that, but that there's still work to be done on that front as well. And so I think Pope Francis's efforts in respect to these very complex, deeply fraught issues could easily be criticized from any number of angles. But when we see the sincerity and the resolve and integrity with which he wanted to make decisions in this regard, his efforts have been very admirable.
On a personal level, Monsignor, what did Pope Francis mean to you in your vocation as a priest and a leader of young people at the University of Mary?
Well, so I remember early on, after he was elected, there was a lot of sort of media attention being given to certain aspects of things that the Pope was saying. And I was trying to navigate all of that and understand best how to respond in my own responsibilities. You know, I'm not a pope or a bishop. I don't have vast responsibilities in the church, but I am responsible for the University of Mary and for my people who are here, the young people at the university, my faculty and staff. And I remember at that point I was reading a biography of Pope Francis by Austin Ivory, who's an Englishman who had done his doctoral dissertation on the history of the church, the recent history of the church in Argentina. And so he was well suited to write a biography of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, which was the name of Francis before he was elected. And I was very moved when I took up that biography and when I read about Archbishop Bergoglio's courage in the face of the dirty war. In other words, during the time when he was in leadership, both of the Jesuits and as a young bishop, Argentina was being gripped by tremendous political turmoil in which people were being taken in the middle of the night and then dropped into the sea from helicopters. I mean, it was a horrible time. And Pope Francis personally assisted in smuggling people out to Europe through Brazil in the midst of that terrifying war in Argentina. And I remember thinking about the challenges of my own daily work. You know, we have all kinds of challenges at the university, as you might imagine, budgetary problems and personnel problems and all kinds of things. I mean, the university is in very good shape, But that doesn't come automatically. That comes through a lot of struggle. And so I was thinking, oh my goodness, you know, how difficult can my life be? And then I was just filled with tremendous admiration for him, because I realized that in his priesthood and in his life, he really, really had put himself at great danger for the sake of those who were vulnerable and who were in need of assistance and help and even rescue. And I remember that just making a big impression on me, Craig, such that I thought, the church is being led by a person of profound personal courage, and there's something to be said for that. And so I think that going all the way back to that realization, that has been sort of a pilot light. Remember the old pilot lights in a gas stove? That it was like a pilot light for me in terms of my affection for Pope Francis all through these years.
Is that what you'll miss most about him, not just as the Bishop of Rome, but as a spiritual father to the global church?
Well, so, you know, he's only just gone. And so I think that this is a time of grieving, and feelings and memories are going to be complicated and emerge over the course of time. But I think that my first blush response would be yes, that he did bring in many ways a kind of freshness. His leadership, which was very, very inspiring. He also brought a terrific resilience. I remember I was at a papal audience with him maybe 3 years ago. 3 years ago this coming May, I was with him, and I watched. He was having so much trouble getting around. He could scarcely walk at that point. And I remember looking at him and being just very struck and wondering how much longer he might live. But of course, since then, he's done all kinds of international trips. He was hospitalized. He came out of the hospital. He really has had this type of interior tenacity and resilience, which is really quite impressive, Craig. Mm-hmm. And so I admire that very much as well, and I think he'll be missed for his tirelessness. And that is something that we appreciate here in North Dakota, isn't it? A person with a good, strong work ethic, that's someone you can admire. And in the Pope, we really had someone like that.
As we wrap up our conversation this morning, and I really appreciate your time on what must be an unplanned and busy day for you, Monsignor, but as we all grieve, as the world grieves, what spiritual message or call to action would you offer to North Dakotans today who are reflecting on Pope Francis's death?
You know, North Dakota is full of Catholics and non-Catholics, but it's important to note that for those of us who are Catholics, the passage of a pope is not simply a political event. Catholics in North Dakota might really admire him or might have been put on edge by him or whatever, but he's the father of our family, and we call him Holy Father, not for nothing. And so I think that that I would say to North Dakotans who are not Catholic, if you have a close friend who's a Catholic, to express a sense of solidarity and condolence is a really appropriate thing to do at this time. In addition to that, I would say that for all of us, not to forget Pope Francis's emphasis. He wanted a poor church for the poor. That's what he said when he chose Francis as his name, again, following St. Francis of Assisi. I would say that it's important for us not to forget that message. We live in a time of unprecedented affluence. Our lives are pretty comfortable, but there are lots of people in the world who don't live like we do. And so to remember that, and not just to pray, but to act in respect to that, is deeply important in our own time. Never to forget the poor.
We've appreciated our conversation with Monsignor James Patrick Shea, who has served as the president of the University of Mary since 2009. We're reflecting on the news that Pope Francis has died today, just one day after appearing publicly to bless crowds for Easter, including students who were in the very front row at the Vatican from the University of Mary. Monsignor, thank you so much for taking time to join us today on Main Street.
Craig, I'm so grateful to you for reaching out, and thank you for covering this important event, both for the church and for the world.
Thank you so much. It was my honor.
Support for Pray Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Main Street continues on this Monday here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Earth Day celebrations are planned for tomorrow and Thursday in Valley City, and these events are part of Earth Week, organized by Valley City State University, the Barnes County Historical Society, and the community campus group, What in the World is Going On? Today, we visit with Patrick Sommer. He is a Dark Sky International Delegate dedicated to raising awareness about the effects of light pollution on ecosystems, human health, and our connection to the night sky. And we visit with Dr. Rebecca Phillips. She's the founder and executive director of Ecological Insights, where she leads groundbreaking research on soil carbon, regenerative grazing, and climate resilience across the northern Great Plains. Also with us, Matt Waxler, an Emmy-nominated documentary filmmaker who will show his movie, The Jungle, exploring the intersection of food systems, environmental justice, and rural America. Before we get into Earth Week activities at Valley City State University, I would like to ask each of you your perspective on what Earth Day is. We celebrate it every year on April 22nd, but why is it important that we think about it? Dr. Phillips, let me just start with you.
Well, Earth Day is just a way, in my mind, of showing our appreciation for the Earth and all that it does. It was in an Earth Day in the late 80s that I attended for the first time that awakened my desire to study how the natural world works. So if there's a chance that other people can learn and appreciate the Earth and all the things that it provides for us, I think it's a great thing to do.
Matt, what about you?
I think we constantly need a reset about what it means to be part of this planet and a contributor to the ecosystem that we are a part of. And Earth Day represents an opportunity to hit that reset button, to ground ourselves in the reality of what we're facing in terms of climate change and how we can provide for generations ahead.
Patrick, your perspective.
I would piggyback off of what Matt just said. It's been over my lifetime a very important day to remember what we can do as an individual species to help protect the planet, but also try to remember how deeply we're connected to it as a whole and how our survival depends on it.
I have the feeling that Earth Day was more important to all of us maybe 20 years ago than it seems to be today. Would you all agree or would you disagree with that?
I think it maybe was more novel 20 years ago than it is now, and we take so much for granted. But I think it's more important now than it's ever been. I think we are, if you have kids like I do, you have to really think about what their future is going to be like and how the climate of the Earth is going to impact that.
There are those who are listening who may disagree with that perspective. What might you say to them? Go ahead, Patrick.
While I understand the wide and varied level of opinions on the science, I tend to agree more with the actual science of it. And I would also ask those people that I know are out there and people that I do know, if you want to look at what you can see with your own eyes, there is ample evidence that climate change is happening, is impacting all of us on a daily basis almost. And you can see it. Floods, storms, fires, a wide variety of impacts.
I just want to toss this out there. Some might say, you look at history, it's always been cyclical like that.
I mean, certainly, you know, you've seen over the course of hundreds of thousands of years, numerous ice ages and that cycle repeating itself over and over again. I don't really think the question is whether or not climate change is real or not. The question is, do you plan to eat 30 years from now? Do you plan to have security within having heat for your home or having air conditioning for your home? Do you plan to drink water in the future? If you plan to do any of these things in the future, you should be concerned about regulating the climate for yourself and for your children.
Dr. Phillips, any perspective?
Well, I'd like to just help people to understand. I know that there's a greater awareness of carbon in the environment, and my field is how material and energies move throughout the planet. And so if people could just get a picture of how carbon moves throughout the environment in every living organism in different forms, and that it's all just part of a cycle. And those kinds of things, I think, are important for people to understand, and that rangelands, our grasslands, are important sinks for that carbon. They're important mechanisms for drawing down the carbon in the air, putting it back in the ground. It's a way to help mitigate some of those emissions, and that we can improve the ground, improve our soils for agriculture, and take some of that excess carbon out of the air all at the same time for a win-win for everybody.
At 7 p.m. on Tuesday, the film The Jungle will be shown, and that will be viewed at the Rhodes Science Center. It's an update on Upton Sinclair's 1906 book about the American meat industry. Matt, introduce this film to us.
Yeah, so this is my third film on food, agriculture, and the environment. And I really started my journey over 10 years ago looking at the difference between local food systems and the food system at large and how it impacts health and local economies. And it's just been, every film has led me to the next one. That led me to one called Right to Harm, which was about environmental injustice of rural community members living around factory farms. And along the way of making that film, I talked to a lot of farmers who just kept telling me about the massive consolidation within the meat industry and how it basically parallels the monopolies that existed in the early 1900s, which Upton Sinclair wrote about.
Did that surprise you that the parallels are still there today?
It kind of did surprise me, because in doing the other two films, I had heard a lot of things of nothing was wrong before the 1960s. You know, everything was fine. And as history has shown, that's really not the case at all. We've had massive issues with the meat industry since its inception in the mid-1800s. It's taking of land that was maintained by the keystone species of the buffalo, and capitalizing on that land to produce a product that was then shipped mostly to the East Coast and then eventually all over the world, and has decimated the Great Plains ecosystem at large, and has been part of decimating other ecosystems around the country as well. And so that was kind of a coordinated plan by oligarchs at the time to control a very large section of the food industry. There was eventual legislation that helped to break up that monopoly in 1921, the Packers and Stockyards Act, and that is one piece of legislation that has not been enforced over the past 20 years as massive consolidations have happened within the meat industry.
What is the reaction that you recognize from audiences who have seen The Jungle?
It's not as gory, the film, as the book is described. The film absolutely centers more around what Upton Sinclair meant the book to be about, which was about worker exploitation. And then this film is really meant to connect the issues of the meat industry to the ecosystem and agriculture at large, and how it's destroying the planet in the process of existing, but also shows how the reverse can be true. We can actually have a system that produces animals for consumption, but also is part of environmental stewardship and ecosystem services. So there is some hope in the film.
Patrick, at 7 o'clock on Thursday, April 24th, at the Barnes County Historical Society Museum, the film Northern Nights, Starry Skies will be shown. And this is something that you are very interested in. Tell us about what your relationship is to the film.
The film was produced by Travis Novitzky. He is a member of the Grand Portage Anishinaabe, I'm going to mispronounce that, nation of Northeast Minnesota. And he's a photographer of wildlife and night skies, lifelong activist in that region for the night skies. He's active with Dark Sky International, which is the organization I represent. The film highlights both his work
and the importance of protecting the nighttime environment. And when we talk about the environment, even though it's Dark Sky International, we're not solely focused, at least anymore, on the skies. We're working more towards dark restoration, nighttime restoration. My personal view of nighttime is it's the last area of rest and respite and recovery for many species that we have. And over especially the last 150, 200 years, we've worked as hard as we can to banish natural night. And if we do that, how many species have managed to at least marginally adapt to the pressures that humans have put on them? You take away their night, that might be the thing that pushes them over the edge. That's one of my interests, along with the cultural connections that the night sky represents. And that's what I'll talk about briefly before the film shows. The areas that there are stories all around the world based on the night sky and how that connects us. It's one of the easiest methods to obtain a sense of awe and of wonder in your life. And it used to be that way for everyone. They could just walk out their door and look up. And with the advent of the electric light and more recently LED lightings, it's lost for the majority of urban and even small Midwestern city dwellers. They just cannot see the night sky, and much less something like the Milky Way.
Each of you are going to probably interact with college students. Do you find that today folks who are of college age are more interested in the earth and in climate than perhaps folks from my generation, us older folks, are?
I think so. I'm not as connected to young people as I'd like to be, but I think that people are talking more about this topic today than they used to when I started studying this. I remember working on my PhD and my mother telling me carbon dioxide is just boring, but but now people are understanding what it is, and they're, you know, they seem to want to learn more about climate change. At least that's my take on it.
I also find that young students are very eager to look at solutions for how to fix these problems, not just to learn about it, but wanting to engage and figuring out what their part is, their role is in solution-based thinking.
We're in a political environment, as you all know, and I'm sure as our listeners all know, where the United States has withdrawn from their international climate commitments. There's a promotion of fossil fuels and a curtailment of renewable energy projects. What do you feel when you've dedicated a good portion of your life to this issue, but then political thinking is trying to shift away from what it is that you're concerned about?
Political thinkers are oftentimes very short-term, and this to me sounds like short-term thinking. When you dedicate your life to the earth and its value as your life support system, and you want to keep things in balance and you want to keep it sustainable, you know that eventually politics will change and it'll come around. It's really unfortunate that we don't want to diversify our energy options, especially in this increasing need for more energy. Why wouldn't we want to tap every source of energy available? That doesn't sound very sensible to me, but I don't think it's going to last, personally.
When you hear that climate research is defunded.
Yeah, it's very disheartening. I really feel for the new PhDs and postdocs that are now out of a job because the research they've dedicated themselves to is no longer funding them. I'm personally defunded in some respects because of this new political shift. And I would just encourage everybody to hang in there because we have to, you know, I don't think that it's going to last because climate change is not going to stop tomorrow just because the politics have changed. And as more and more big cities feel rising sea levels and there's issues with they're losing properties and the sea surface temperatures are rising and there's problems with fish and this becomes a bigger problem. You hate to see it have to go to that point, but that might be what needs to happen before people take this seriously.
Matt or Patrick, anything to add from your perspective?
In total agreement with what Dr. Phillips said and kind of believe the same thing. At the end of the day, the changes that we're all fighting for are inevitable it's inevitable that the Earth will win this battle, whichever way it decides to do it. I've always been a believer that we need to hit rock bottom in order to start pulling ourselves out and start making the right decisions. I guess over the past 10 years, I thought we hit that several times. It's just hard to know where the bottom is. And I think we're about to experience what the bottom really is potentially in the next 5 to 10 years. And maybe it's a necessity that as a collective society that we experience that so that we can all agree upon a better solution as opposed to what's happening right now.
Yes, I would agree with both of you. And I'm not nearly as vested professionally in what the current political environment has created in the climate and environmental space as both of you might be. As a volunteer, as an advocate that doesn't work 100% of the time in the sphere, it's bad enough. And I agree with you, Matt. I don't think we've quite hit rock bottom, although I have thought several times we've made it there. And I also agree with you, Dr. Phillips, that there's likely going to be a massive shift in the next few years. What I tell the students, and a lot of times I am speaking to student groups at the collegiate level, what I tell them is just to hang on and pick. Don't get overwhelmed by the number of environmental issues. Latch on to something that you're comfortable with or that you're studying and keep pressing ahead with that and keep talking and keep working on that. It's one reason I'm sitting here in the light pollution arenas because I'm not as much of an expert in all the others and I would get lost. And if you get lost, you just shut down. And that's something none of us can afford to do right now.
One of my main concerns with all of this is if I were a young person who wanted to do exactly that, Patrick, but I'm looking at the reality of funding, of the fiscal end of this, of whether grants will be available, boy, that would concern me.
It is extremely concerning. I just wrapped up another master's with an eye on my post-retirement career, having another job out there. And that master's was in sustainability, security from a human security perspective, and resilience. And all of a sudden, everything I can see for the next, 4 to 8 to 10 years doesn't look so great for the job market. It is the toughest part of the conversation when I'm done presenting the relatively easy solutions to my piece of advocacy is to frame it in that there is still potential out there down the road. It's just, we are at a point where it's going to take a little bit of hard work and a little more patience than I might have.
The silver lining is that you've armed yourself with the information of how to survive potentially, right?
Yes.
I find that important. Over the last 15 years, in making these films, my goal has just been to arm myself with the information to survive what will come ahead of us. And there is something to that. It takes a lot of stress out of your life because these are major, major issues that people can have anxiety about to no end. But if you can arm yourself with solutions and you can personally implement some of those solutions, you will not only find peace within that, but you will find a connection with the planet that you potentially did not have previously.
This is an international problem. I know we're focused on domestic politics, but I have personally worked overseas. I find that there's a lot of research being done all over the world. And I'm not encouraging our brilliant young people necessarily, but to go elsewhere, but there are opportunities elsewhere. You know, there are this whole idea of carbon markets, even China is on board with that. So there are places if a person really wants to do research if they're not available in the US.
The events we've been talking about are Earth Week celebrations. Earth Day is Tuesday, April 22nd. Begins at 1 o'clock with a lecture by Dr. Rebecca Phillips, and at 7 o'clock, a screening of the movie The Jungle. And then on Thursday at the Barnes County Historical Society Museum, at 7 o'clock, a screening of the film Northern Nights, Starry Skies. Earth Week events are sponsored by Valley City State University, the Barnes County Historical Society, and What in the World is Going On? It's a community group all events, and this is the most important, are free and open to the public, and we hope all can attend. To my panel, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Craig.
Thank you.
Support for PrairiePublic is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Decoded Datebook for April 21st. During this week, in 1996, Roosevelt Elementary School in Fargo, North Dakota, celebrated its 75th anniversary. Among the honored guests was one of the school's most beloved retired teachers, 91-year-old music instructor Martha Hook. Mrs. Hook taught at Roosevelt from 1952 to 1969 and was best known for introducing ukuleles to the school orchestra in 1959. That year, the school inherited 2 ukuleles, and Mrs. Hook, enchanted by their sound, saw the potential. Affordable for families and excellent for teaching harmony, the small instrument quickly became a staple. Under her guidance, the Roosevelt Elementary School Orchestra grew from just 2 ukulele players to an impressive 60 students, ranging from 3rd to 6th grade. Mrs. Hook was born in Fargo in 1904, 17 years before Roosevelt Elementary was built. As a young girl, she saw Theodore Roosevelt speak in Fargo in 1910. She pursued her passion for music at the Dakota Conservatory of Music and Morehead State Teachers College, now Minnesota State University Morehead. After teaching in Menomon, Minnesota, and Fargo, she married Aubrey Hook in 1928 and stepped away from teaching to raise a family. But in 1952, after her husband's untimely passing at the age of 47, she returned to the classroom. Her dedication to music education earned her the Fargo Lions Club's Teacher of the Year Award in 1968. Despite her many achievements, Mrs. Hook faced profound personal hardships. In June of 1957, while visiting her son in California, her home was destroyed by an F5 tornado. Years later, in 1974, while on another visit to her son, the building that housed her antique store was lost to a fire, destroying most of her carefully collected wares. Undeterred, she continued running her antique store, Hook's Home, for years in the DeLondersey's building on Main Avenue. Martha Hook passed away in 1988 at the age of 94 and is still fondly remembered by her ukulele-strumming former students. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. And I'm one of Mrs. Hook's former ukulele students, and her inspirational teaching led to my career in music and performing. Thank you to Martha Hook. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus joins forces with the Central Dakota Children's Choir for a performance on April 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Belmehus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Coming together includes Can You Feel the Love Tonight from Disney's The Lion King, Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms, and Johannes Brahms' Schicksalsleads. Tickets are available online at bismancivicchorus.com or at the door.
The Catholic Church begins its 9 days of official mourning after the death of Pope Francis. We'll hear about what comes next on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Monday's Main Street. We are grateful that you've spent time with us today. Tomorrow on the show, our friend, travel writer Alicia Underlee-Nelson. She'll have the best tips for those of us who are planning to travel here within the region, across the country, and even overseas. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.